Time for Reason. This afternoon, Lyman Bryson returns to Time for Reason, resuming his series of talks on international affairs after a two-week tour of Austria. Speaking from Paris, Mr. Bryson will discuss the East End of Europe. And now to Paris and Lyman Bryson.
When you travel in Middle Europe for a week or two, as I have just been doing, and begin to have real people in your mind instead of empty symbols, you realize that what is going on in the Russian end of Europe is not so much a contest between political philosophies as it looks from a distance. The people of the Eastern European countries are not really choosing between democracy and communism, or capitalism and communism, as much as we think they are. Tremendous changes are coming into their lives. They are trying to understand them. They follow the leaders who give them what they think are the most convincing explanations. We all know that we have to put ourselves, if we can, into the places of these people in the East End of Europe and try to understand, if we can, just how things look to them. But it's a difficult thing to do. It requires an effort of the imagination and of sympathy. We have to realize the force of arguments that we don't like. We have to admit as truth, for example, that in all the East European countries that are now under the domination of Russia, there are a good many people who are not communists, people who do not believe in the political principles of communism or in communist economics, but who are convinced, nevertheless, that their countries are making rapid material progress and that it is Russian influence and Russian help and communist guidance that is bringing this progress to them. One fact that makes this possible is that the progress in all these countries, for which the communist governments naturally claim all the credit, is real. They really are better off than they were. It is the natural recovery from the devastation and unproductiveness of the war years. A country of simple industrial structure, a country where most people are farmers and workers in the small crafts, where there is very little large-scale manufacturing, can usually recover quickly from a war or a depression. Now, of course, this is not the kind of country in which Karl Marx expected capitalism to develop. But that's an old story, too. It is developing there in spite of it. The industrial and business organization in a country like this is simple, and it is a simple matter to get it going again when it's smashed up. There never are and cannot be in countries like Yugoslavia and Romania the great dislocations that a war brings to a country like Great Britain or the United States or France or Germany. The men go back to the plow or to the workbench. The standard of living, which never was very high anyhow, is soon back to something like normal. I do not mean, of course, that these countries do not suffer great loss. They do. They suffer horribly in war. But they do not have the extra difficulties of a complicated machine economy, and they can more quickly get back to normal business. And the communists in these Eastern governments, backed by the immense authority of Russia, tell the people that they are getting ahead because of communist guidance and communist ideas. And the people find it very easy to believe whether or not it is true. And another thing in their favor now, these countries were all on the verge of a considerable industrial development when the Second World War broke out. How great that development would have been if there had not been a war is certainly an impossible question, and how great it can ever be is a very difficult one. I am not at all convinced that it is ever going to be possible to make a first-class industrial region out of Eastern Europe. I do not believe that Russia can set up a self-sufficient bloc against the Marshall Plan, an economic organization that would enable those Eastern countries under her direction and guidance to be self-sufficient without help, capitalization, machinery, expert guidance from the West and from America. I don't believe that. But certainly the present tendency, nevertheless, is toward an increase in power production. And the peasants of Yugoslavia or Bulgaria can easily be persuaded that under the tremendous propaganda influences that the communists can exert, can easily be persuaded that this industrial development could never have happened without communist guidance. You see, it happens in these satellite countries just as it did in Russia itself. Most Russians firmly believe that they would never have had factories and power dams and subways and electric machinery if it hadn't been for Lenin and Karl Marx. The fact that other countries have had these things for years and have more of them than the Russians have been able to get, all without the blessing of communism, doesn't matter. The fact that Germany, before the war, and Britain and America have much better developed industrial plants and have gotten more efficient production out of their resources than communism has as yet been able to produce in Russia, doesn't matter. The Russians got industries and they got communism at the same time. So there are a good many people from Moscow to Warsaw and down to every little southern village who believe that communism brought them into the modern world of factories and of power. And each of these East European countries has now its own special problems. There's one basic problem that is common to several of them, a problem that is obscured in the political news that we get from their capital cities. We get the political news that makes dramatic headlines. We get the news of dispute and conflict. And of course, that's real, and it will affect their future. But some of the slow changes that we hear very little about are probably more important in the long run. Take, for example, the land question. In many of these East European regions, the working farmers for years, for centuries even, have been trying to get possession of the land they live on. It doesn't make any difference that in Russia, where communism has had 30 years, more than a generation to develop, the land is not at all in the hands of the peasants, but is mostly combined in the great state farms run by a factory system. That doesn't matter. That doesn't worry the peasant, say, in Poland, who's got hold of his own land at last, who's been given possession of it by the government, the communist government, and who has seen that communist government break up the old baronial estates and destroy the feudal system that was a relic of the Middle Ages. Now nobody is telling him, that is nobody in whom he has any confidence is telling him, that the communists who are in control of his own government, the Polish government, are very likely to take the land away from him again and go still further in the direction of the Russian pattern. Nobody knows that they are, but it is likely, because that is the Russian pattern, and it is the communist pattern. The peasant doesn't believe it. The accidents of history have made him think that he has to choose between the old system of great estates and poor peasants as one choice, and a communist government with farmers owning and managing their own farms as the other choice. He chooses the present system, the system that gives him his land. What I've just been saying applies most fully, I think, to Poland. It is somewhat true also in Yugoslavia and Bulgaria, less so perhaps in Romania. In all these places, in varying degrees, the peasants who are convinced that the communist governments are good, and this is by no means all of them, as everybody knows, and in many regions, not more than a small minority, but all those peasants who are convinced that communism is a good system for the future are making that choice, it appears, largely because of the communist land policy. And most of these countries have a dominant peasant population. They are, and they always have been, farming countries. And that is a policy which has a tremendous appeal for them. The one country that we think of as more or less under the domination of the Russians, but which shows a strikingly different picture, is Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia is the one Eastern country that shows most signs of being still more or less independent. Czechoslovakia has been an important industrial country for a long time. The Czechs didn't need to wait for the Russian communists to tell them how to build factories. The factories of Prague and Pilsen, the great breweries, the great gunworks, the great shoe factories, were the heart of the industrial power of the old Austrian Empire before the First World War. And it was the loss of that industrial power when Czechoslovakia regained its independence and became again a country where Czechs could run their own affairs. It was that that completely ruined the Austrian Empire. That's now more or less ancient history. And the people of Czechoslovakia seem to have forgotten that they were part of Central Europe, that part of the Central Europe where the culture of the Slavic people overlapped the culture of the Germans. They are Slavs in race and language, very proud of it. Their farming regions are Slavic in their customs. But in their cities, they have had, for many generations, a good deal of the German industrial tendency and have developed industrial activity in a very German way. It's not easy to explain the fact that the Czechs rely on Russia, as we've explained it in other places, by saying that the Czech communists are clever politicians and win over the farmers by a liberal land policy, and that new industries where they exist seem to be the gifts of Marxism and Russian help. Now, the Czech reliance on Russia has to be explained in other ways, because the Czechs do not suddenly come into an industrial era now. They have been there for a long time. They're used to it. But part of their dependence on Russia, of course, is historical. They remember, better than we do, perhaps, that they were the ones who were sold out to the Germans when Chamberlain first tried to buy off Hitler by appeasement. It will take more than one generation for them to forget that, and ever again to believe very firmly in the good faith of Western powers. And their policy is based also, of course, on geography. They are living between Russia and Germany, between Russia and the Western powers. They are, in the very real sense, under the guns. In spite of this, the government of Czechoslovakia, a compromise government made up of others in addition to the communists, is stubbornly hanging on to all its connections with the Western powers. Pictures just published by the Czech government show that although international trade between Czechoslovakia and her eastern neighbors is steadily increasing, the Western powers are still her biggest customer and sell her the most goods. In total trade, Czechoslovakia did business with other countries in this order. First, Great Britain. Second, Switzerland. And after that, in order, Sweden, the United States, Bulgaria, Russia, Holland, Yugoslavia, and Belgium. Note the Western powers there. In the list of countries sending goods into Czechoslovakia, Great Britain was first and the United States was second. We have a stake in this Western trade. It would greatly help the whole European situation if we could develop more trade of the same sort with other Eastern European countries. It's to our advantage whenever a country on this side of Berlin sets up a trade agreement with a country on the other side. Like, for example, the agreement now being discussed between Poland and Denmark, two countries that can profitably exchange goods and eventually, one hopes, political ideas and goodwill. Now, to say that the communist case is made out with the leaders in these eastern countries is convincing to the people is not to say that there is in all these countries any real debate of the issues. With the exception, again, of Czechoslovakia, there appears to be very little real debate in these countries and almost no free talk. The communists in power have played the old game of putting the opposition into jail or driving it out of the country. But given their tactics that are so unfair from our democratic point of view, they still do offer programs, they do act in ways that make the people think they have political reasons on their side, and they still do fill the young people with enthusiasm, because the young people have never known anything else. It is in no case a simple matter of gangster politics winning out against clearly felt and clearly expressed opposition. It's brutality plus some very good arguments, a curious combination, but not altogether new in politics in any country. When we think of these things, it is surprising that the communists, the Russians, are having any difficulty in taking any of these countries over, since they are willing to use force and threats to get rid of strong rivals, and since they are clever enough to take advantage of the political realities and to claim credit for all the favorable things that are happening. It ought really to be easier for them than it is. But of course they are at the same time making mistakes. Their occupation armies are living on the country. And they have, in their administration of these countries, mixed altogether too much fear in with their clever politics. As a consequence, the average citizen in Western Europe has a picture of Russia which is partly made by chance. He may think that Russia is wonderful. He may think that communism is wonderful. He may think that Russia is a great friend to his country. He may believe that it is the hope of the world, while at the same time he ducks when he sees a Russian soldier on the street. That is, it may be that in his personal acquaintance with Russians, in his business, or in some other contact, he's found them not too fair, perhaps a little unreasonable, perhaps positively brutal. But at the same time, he feels that the overshadowing power of Russia and the overwhelming arguments which the communists offer him are the only things he can accept. Nobody can say how much a mixed-up situation of this sort will work itself out. For Americans, the chief problem, if we want to think clearly, is to remember how complicated it is and never to forget that the Russians and their communist followers in all these countries are not fools, and they do not depend entirely on force. They have good arguments on their side. I return you now to CBS in New York.
You have just heard Lyman Bryson discussing the East End of Europe in his regular Sunday series, Time for Reason. Mr. Bryson spoke from Paris. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.